or visually inspecting the tubes is enough. I mean, you can just read the first line on it, and everything is easy. Yes, there are plenty of things you can do very easy and find out if the tube is good and what is the condition of the tube and to extreme.
Okay, I don't think it's the be-all, end-all, because there are some aspects of a malfunctioning tube that won't really show up. Unfortunately, part three of this list is to use a tube tester. So, you got the same thing going on either way. I mean, it's always nice to check that it glows and it doesn't rattle and that it didn't fog up and there's no cracks. There's mechanical stability, electrical conductance, but push comes to shove, ultimately, it's always nice to have a tube tester.
Not everybody has it and wants to have it. I was married with a few thousands of tubes, and they're lying somewhere in my storage room because it was given to me, and I don't know what to do with it. But those points, since the question was, can you visually or very simple way test the vacuum tubes? Yeah, here you are. Those points, take it and at least part of it, and apply it as an answer. And talk to you.
N2EPQ.
Yes.
I think the tube market is all about it. And there's serious stuff going on because a lot of the people that are manufacturing tubes now are either in the Ukraine or in Russia. So it's caused a really serious shortage. It's tragic. But anyway, I have tubes in my guitar amplifiers, and I went to a local guy at one of the guitar amplifier repair places. And they have a good tube tester, so I was able to bring tubes in there, and he gave me, he gave me information on how my tubes were. And sometimes it pays to do that. He'll charge a couple of bucks, but it's worth it. So anyway, and also on Facebook, I joined a group. It's Tube Guitar Amplifiers, and these guys are always talking about tubes and how to test them and whatnot. So if anybody wants to join a group like that, they can do that and get tons of information. So I'll just put in my 2 cents back to Ned.
It's a great point.
Yes, I agree. That's a good point, Pete. Thank you for that. By the way, want to call out a new amateur radio operator with a new call sign. He's been showing up on the chat room. Hopefully one of these days he'll show up on the repeater, KD2ZAN. Paul, congratulations on your new call sign. So he's in the chat room right now, so I don't know if he's able to transmit. But if he isn't, if he is, congratulations, Paul. Anyway, so I will, when I get a chance, and I'm not doing three things at one time, I will post a link to the article on testing a vacuum tube visually in other ways on my link page, so you can look for it later on. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Limark Technical Net, and hopefully we can help you with technical problems or questions or discuss concepts or what have you. So if you're out there and you have a question or a topic, please give me your first name and your call sign.
KG2RY.
KG2 Bravo Zulu.
Okay, David recognized, Rich recognized. You have another question, Rich? I know you have the medical question.
I decided to switch it to a technical question in that I wonder why the cable companies went to 75 ohms when at least our world has been centered on 50 ohms why did they choose 75 over 50 or 75 over whatever?
WA2VDH with the answer.
Okay, John, we've mentioned it before, but please, John, tell us.
If you plot cable loss versus impedance, it takes a minimum at around 72 ohms. Power handling capability is maximized around 40 or 30 ohms. So cable companies are interested in minimum loss. So that's why they chose 75.
Thank you, John. And the reason why we selected 50 was to split the difference between loss and power handling capability.
So their power constraints were different than ours.
Yeah, they're driven by loss. They're most interested in having minimum loss because that means the number of repeating amplifiers they have to put out in the street, out in the system.
I see. Thank you. That's the answer to my question, Roy. If you want to go to my medical one, it's there too.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll go to David since he mentioned he has a question, and then we'll come back to you, okay? So, David, what's your question for tonight?
Vibration. Why do certain vibrations heal or relax or somehow positively affect a person's health as opposed to other vibrations that are very disturbing and bad for somebody's health?
Okay, this is a territory where some people get very mystical, and I would prefer if at all possible, not to be too mystical about it. There are frequencies are one of those new age things that people talk about. They're properties of waves, and so it depends upon the medium that you're talking about of what the frequency is doing. So you either have pressure waves directly touching a part of a body that might be soothing under some circumstances if they're slow rhythmic and they don't produce excessive heat and irritation, they can be soothing. And then there's totally different where air is the medium and it's acoustic waves. And acoustic waves can have different qualities depending upon what frequency it is. Very low infrasonic waves have been known to make people feel unsteady or in danger. There's an occasional paper that suggests that people who think they live in haunted houses have some things that manifest infrasonic sound generation that they're unaware of that gives them that sense. High enough frequency, you don't hear. Too loud a frequency that you can hear can be painful. So different mediums and different frequencies have different qualities depending upon the individual. Are you going to be healed by a vibration? I don't think so. You might be soothed. You might be calmed. You might feel a little bit better, but I don't quite know if vibrating your flesh at a particular frequency is going to accelerate the natural processes of healing. That's still up to conjecture.
Well, maybe, you know, my question is, if something is good for your health, could the effect be through the brain? The brain, you know, as you hear it and you receive it through your ears and somehow translate it into sound as we perceive it, you know, also sounds that are really awful, you know, really loud, noisy, how to say, audio sounds, or maybe even just RF radio frequency in the shack while you're operating your ham radio.
Well, for the most part, the RF frequencies are probably not going to have an immediate effect. Most of the effect is local heating. So, you know, things like your eyeball are probably the most sensitive, enclosed, thermally insulated area of your body. So people are particularly concerned about cell phones being put close up to the face. As far as audible frequencies, yeah, they have all kinds of an emotional effect. That's somewhat what music is all about. Musical techniques can be used to produce a sense of anticipation, of fear, of calm, of relaxation, all manner of things. And we're not even getting into the harsh atonic, non-harmonic type of sounds that some cultures actually prefer to the music that you know, Western civilization has kind of used. But then there's also, when you talk about the mind, there's two ways of interpreting that comment. One is, again, that you know, music soothes the savage beast, but there's also a placebo effect. If I convince someone, even slightly, that running an 80 hertz tone at a very low amplitude is going to make them feel calm, it's very possible that the placebo effect will do just that. So that's a power that the brain has. It's not directly related to the stimuli. It's associated with the stimuli, and the brain does it itself. So, that's my two cents worth on the topic, as I perceive you asking.
What if you've got a list of 12 of your favorite songs that make you feel really good? You know, maybe that also can have an effect on a person's health, in the sense that, you know, positive energy, positive vibes, you know, can make somebody feel better, you know. Even my brother-in-law went in for some surgery, very simple surgery, and the doctor in the clinic played some 70s rock for my brother-in-law, you know, as he was coming out of the surgery.
Well, a lot of surgeons will play music in the surgical theater. They enjoy the music. It makes them feel better. They assume it'll make the nurses and the anesthesiologists feel reasonably pleasant. And yeah, if you play music that you find pleasant, it will calm you down. It will make you happier. That's why we buy music. That's why we play music. That's why we enjoy music. The same difference. Every so often you'll hear these weird stories of cults who kind of lock them and hostages up, and over the long haul, at one point or another, the FBI starts to blare really loud, annoying music that most people don't really like, with the idea that it will disturb, disrupt, confuse, and improve the FBI's picture. So I'm not quite sure if its frequencies just kind of resonate with people. It's just that the brain likes different tones. They're soothed by those tones, and that's just the nature of music. If it wasn't for that, there would probably be a lot less music sales.
It makes me think of military personnel. They're in the airplane, the jet, going into combat, and they have certain music playing to get them all pumped up.
Well, yeah, again, I mean, we've sort of seen that as well in combat movies where they're setting the tone, and you know, there's an enormous number of scenes from the Vietnamese War on, where some guy is in a helicopter or a plane waiting to parachute out, and he pulls up one of those big radios and starts playing some rock or metal or something to kind of rev up the people getting ready for war. So, again, music it can be imbued with a great deal of emotional content. Musicians kind of learn that in Music Theory 101. You know, how do you make people calm? How do you make people nervous? How do you give anticipation? And guys who write the musical scores for movies just pull that out every single movie. You could kind of see what's going on in the background just listening to the music score change so that it's kind of attempting to manipulate your emotions. So, you know, there's a lot said about the area in your brain that perceives acoustic signals and translates them, that it runs really close to the fibers that act as the emotional gates. So there's a lot of interaction between sounds and emotions. So there's a lot of that goes on with music and sound in general.
Well, you know, I've seen these 8-hour, 11-hour long music videos, you know, with a picture of a Buddhist monk sitting on a rock looking out into the landscape with energy moving around in the picture. It says a certain frequency, and it's always different frequencies, you know, where I guess it's the A major tone, and certain frequency, whatever it is, you know, and it's very relaxing. The other thing I wanted to say, too, is that, you know, I spent a lot of time and effort trying to get my radios to sound really good because, you know, I felt kind of stressed out listening to all that noise.
Well, that is understandable. I mean, we've talked before that one of the best signal processors that anyone has, especially hams, is their brain. We can discern a great deal of information. We can extract intelligent sounds from a crowd, a bunch of people talking simultaneously in a crowded room, but it does require a lot of effort and energy depletion, and it fatigues people. So when you're listening on HF and the background noise is relatively low and the transmissions you receive are easy to understand, you feel a lot less tired at the end of doing that for a while than if you have to just kind of make out what everyone's saying all the time. It can be very fatiguing. So I could understand that. Again, there are tones that are soothing. There are usually atonal combinations that annoy people. So you can annoy people, you can calm people, you can do all kinds of fun things with frequencies. Again, I don't think there's anything mystical, magical, energy-wise. I think it's simply the way that those excitations in your acoustic nerve travel into your brain and are decoded, and, you know, the things that happen along the way with them. So, but, you know, I believe what I could see, what I could test. And people kind of unfortunately use frequency a little bit too easily. A lot of times they don't even attach it to a medium. So it's a frequency for a frequency's sake. And so that's unfortunately not the way that the waves work. You need some kind of a medium. Otherwise, frequency doesn't really mean much.
QSL, thank you, Roy. You know, I set up that Windows 10 computer that I got on the eBay for, you know, very cheap. And I hooked up a Sony stereo mic. Quality of the audio on the other end is pretty good. I get good audio reports from it. And the other, for the receive, I have a SoundLink Mini. It's a Bose SoundLink Mini. Audio is kind of bassy, but it sounds really good. You know, I guess really all I can do is, you know, make it sound good on my end. What other people do, then, you know, I have to accept it.
Yeah. I mean, it ends up being a kind of a mutual thing. You try to give people as clean a signal as humanly possible and leave it to them to tweak it in a way that's most agreeable, non-fatiguing, more easily understood, and settle with that. You can't solve the other guy's problem. You could only solve your own. Probably more accurate is, try not to introduce any kind of complications to your transmission so that it's a nice, clean, simple signal, and if it needs to be manipulated by other people, it's easier to do that than, you know, there are guys out there that go kind of crazy with their gear. If you've ever seen a QRZ page where their audio rack is bigger than their radio rack, they're companding, they're depopping, de-hissing, de-noising. They're doing all kinds of things every which way. I don't know. I think they sort of think they're an FM broadcast studio, but you know, if it gives them pleasure, so be it. But you know, that might cause problems. Every so often, there's some guy who thinks his voice is wonderful with reverb, God forbid, and that's a mess because it's very difficult to extract out that reverb once some guy's inserted it in their signal. Yes, Wesley.
Some people want to buy the old EC10 AM retail transmitters or similar to that one, just AM. And if you notice on 3.5 megahertz, you have few of the stations. They only talk AM because they want to have a broadcast quality. As far as other guys, some of them want to be distinctive. So in the history, there was CB radio when some people used reverb or whatever techniques, and then some of those guys thought, hey, how about we put it to ham radio? Didn't work, was very difficult. But anyhow, it's just a matter of preference. And to actually.
WB2 CQT.
Yes, CQT.
I just wanted to mention about the sounds. There's a growing group of people that live near windmills, and the sound of them apparently makes these people feel physically sick. Have you heard this, Roy?
No, I have not. I guess that theoretically, if you build a windmill that has infrasonic resonances, it can produce that type of effect, but I haven't really heard anyone describe. There are a bunch of people who kind of are anti windmill, but I haven't heard the details that you've added to it. But I can see it as a possibility if it's poorly engineered and does have those infrasonic resonances.
Now, these people were not particularly anti-windmill-type people. They just happened to live within an area where it's a windmill farm. There's a whole group of them, you know. They're very large and maybe 60, 100 feet tall. And they could live a mile away or more, and they could hear and sometimes feel, and they try to go to sleep, and It just upsets their physical well-being. I guess you could look this up and you'll find it if you Google it. That's all. I'm not going to stay on. WB2CPP.
AD2DK.
Yes, John.
You know, to talk about the that vibration thing, I've got some sort of empirical evidence that
may be true. Once I was building a servo-controlled subwoofer for a home audio system, and I was playing around in frequencies below 20 hertz. I don't remember the frequency, but I got to a certain frequency, and a strange thing, I got nauseous at that frequency. It was very unusual. As soon as I changed the frequency, within minutes the nausea disappeared. I went back to that frequency. What do you know? Nausea came back. Very strange.
Okay, good point. As I've mentioned, infrasonic frequencies can have very weird effect on people. Some people have thought that they were being haunted by something that later on they figured out was just vibrating at a very infrasonic frequency. So, yeah, I don't know exactly the mechanism for why GI complaints. I guess theoretically it could be the resonance of your abdominal cavity vibrating back and forth. Probably your nerves ends inside your GI tract and such would not enjoy that experience. But yeah, it's rather spooky. And again, that's probably the origin of a lot of ghost stories.
It was GI in nature. It was more like motion sickness, if that makes any sense.
Okay. Did you have any particular vertigo?
No. It kind of felt like... I don't know if you've been to Epcot Center and you went on that that Mars ride. It was like that.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Rich. Yes, Rich, you wanted to say something?
Theory that the vibrations are affecting the inner ear fluid.
Okay, that's a possibility. That would sort of explain why you would have the motion sickness. But you know, I would tend to assume that you'd also get some residual vertigo on top of that. But yeah, that's a possibility. It's very weird. I haven't really done any good tests myself. Because I just don't have a function generator that goes down that low. I have some nice subwoofers, so I could probably plug them in if I had a function generator, that could be adjusted that way. And I don't know if it's a good experiment. It sounds like it wouldn't be too much fun personally, though. Yes, Wesley.
What frequency can do to the body or to the device. Dr. Roy.
Okay. None of this is particularly written in stone. Yes, some manufacturers sell high-frequency emitters to get rid of flies and mosquitoes. There was an article when I was a kid in Popular Electronics on how to build one of those. I built one, and I could put it right next to a fly, and it would just sit there and stare at me. So I'm kind of dubious that high frequency at any kind of low to medium amplitude has any effect much on insects. Number two, the effect on dogs. I tend to also think that it depends upon the dog. I have played around with high frequency signals, and there are some dogs, again, that just stare at me. True, there are some high frequency generators and some dogs that howl and that sound like they're in pain, but I guess dogs are kind of like human beings, and if you get them old enough, they get kind of deaf. So that's dogs. Third is that, unfortunately, Havana syndrome. We don't really know what that is. Some people think that it's microwave emissions. Why the Cubans would test out state-of-the-art microwaves when these days they can't basically afford anything, I don't know. And they show up all over the world rather randomly. So I'm tending to think that it's kind of a psychological thing as opposed to a death rate, personally. The final answer is yet to be proved. The CIA tends to agree with me, but people don't trust the CIA, so other people believe in microwaves. We'll see. But sound waves can and do have an effect, especially at high amplitudes. You can produce visible pain if the sound level is high enough in decibels. Yes, Jim.
Good evening, Roy. I had a question that's relevant to ham radio and to your line of questioning. I wonder if somebody could explain the concept of beat frequency as it regards to CW. I don't need the dental school answer, just a vague idea of what it's about. I'd appreciate that.
Okay. I'm not a big CW-er, so if there's a big CW-er out there who would like to explain it to Jim, feel free.
WB2GXM?
Yes, Rich.
Beat frequency occurs when you have two audio tones which are very close to each other. So you have 700 hertz and 701 hertz. If you apply them together, the sum and difference will add and subtract, and the sum is, forget that, you're never going to hear it. The difference is going to be 1 hertz. And you will hear that as a pulsing, a one hertz pulse superimposed on the two tones. And that is a beat frequency. And that beat frequency occurs anytime you have any two tones together. The beat frequency is the waves reinforcing and canceling alternately at the beat frequency.
I have a problem with that.
Okay, Wesley, how would you explain beat frequency?
Everything was nicely said and it was properly said. The only problem is that it wasn't said that it's opposite from phase. So if you have in phase, then amplitude adds up and the frequency stays the same. If it's opposite in phase, then you have that 1 hertz. And to actually.
Okay. I think that Rich gave a reasonable, you know, sometimes you complicate things a little bit too much, but ultimately what it amounts to is if you have two signals that aren't equal, the difference between the two is the beat frequency, the number of pulses per second. When you mix two signals, you get the sum and the difference. And so it's the difference that's filtered out. It's in the audio range so that you hear it. The sum you're not going to hear because it will be filtered out as RF.
No, 700 hertz. 700 hertz and 700 hertz, you're not going to hear 1400. But actually, it's not going to be 1400. It's going to be 700. If it's in phase, the amplitude will add up. The frequency will stay the same.
No, I'm answering the question for CW. You're not going to be operating a transmitter at 7,000 hertz. You're going to be operating it at 7 million hertz, but not 7,000 hertz. So the question was based on CW.
Okay. When you're talking about 7 kilohertz, also we're talking about 700 hertz. 700 hertz as an example. So you take 700 hertz in phase with another 700 hertz, the behavior is going to be the same. You're going to have 1400 hertz. But if you sum it, but if you have it in phase, then the 700 hertz stay the same, but the amplitude goes twice. I mean, it goes as a sum of it. Now you have opposite in phase, then you have a 1 hertz difference. And tertiary.
Okay, but the random nature of the universe is that it's not going to be totally in phase or out of phase. So again, you get the sum, you get the difference.
WY to you.
Yes, Mike.
Okay, let me try this one if I could. He was talking, the gentleman was talking about the reception of CW. By the way, the single sideband is handled the same way. You're receiving a signal that gets down-converted eventually to the last IF frequency in a receiver. In a modern receiver, we call that a super-heterodyne receiver. So the input frequency gets down-converted to something else. And I'm going to, for the moment, assume that, let's say it's 455 kilohertz. Now, obviously, you can't hear that. Let me drop a second. So as the CW signal is keyed on and off, if you had a conventional detector, you would probably hear it pulsing in tune with the dits and dahs so that you would hear something changing on the noise level of a receiver, which makes it a little bit difficult to discern. I guess some of the old-time railroad operators could make some sense out of it, but it's kind of difficult. A more convenient thing to do is to hear the presence or absence of a tone that moves in accordance with the dits and dahs. So what we're going to do is we're going to generate a signal inside the receiver that's very close to the IF frequency. So the IF frequency, I said, was 455 kilohertz. I'm going to input my own signal that, let's say, is 456 kilohertz or 454 kilohertz. Make it 1 kilohertz away from the IF, which falls within the audio range. If you now combine these two signals in a nonlinear device, and we happen to call that a product detector, you would generate, like you said, Roy, some in different frequencies. The sum frequency is up there at about 910 kilohertz, which is almost a megahertz, and you cannot hear that. And usually that gets filtered out in a low-pass filter somewhere anyway. But the beat note, the 1 kilohertz tone, which is the difference between the beat frequency oscillator and the IF frequency, which is at 1 kilohertz, can be heard, and that gets sent to an audio amplifier for amplification. And that's what you hear when you have a CW signal coming out of a modern receiver. It's the beat signal frequency between a BFO internally generated and the actual signal at the antenna. WY2U.
AD2DK, great answer.
And thanks, great answer.
Yeah, I second the emotion. Yes, very good way of explaining it. So I hope that that solves the question. I couldn't say it any better than you have done. So any other questions on this subject before we move on to something completely different?
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
I have another technical question. I'll hold my medical question off for another time. But I have a receiving antenna with a little amplifier. I use it to listen to my SDR dongle. Anyway, I'm doing a sweep, a SWR sweep, on one of the frequencies that I want to operate CW on. It's 1-to-1. It's showing a 1-to-1 match on that frequency. The question is, what would be the harm of putting some output power into that antenna at the frequency it's showing a 1-to-1 match on it? Go ahead.
AKG2RY.
Yes, David, recognize. I just wanted to ask Rich a question. Are you still going to have that amplifier in line? Because that would be a no-no.
I could take the amplifier out of the line. That's just for the receiving end, and still get that 1-to-1 match on around 3,100 megahertz, which is where I want to operate.
Okay, if that's the case, I don't really see any particular problem. As long as it's not like you're going to run 1.5 kilowatts or anything and blow everything up. So if it demonstrates that it is a 1-to-1 VISWA, assuming it's not a non-inductive resistive dummy load, I can't see any particular problems in trying it out and seeing if you could be heard.
Hey, there was another station in there?
Yeah, I think David wanted to make a comment. David?
Yeah, I just wanted to tie up the vibrations concept. We were talking about people with really bad audio on like on 20 meters, and they splatter from here to there, and they're really loud, and you know, they have really bad audio, and that for me is very stressful. And also the ICOM IC718 transceiver had a microphone HM36, which, you know, it just didn't modulate. It was kind of dull. So ICOM, I called ICOM, and they said to use the HM219. And, yeah, what a difference. What a difference. So, yeah, people, you know, they can do something on their end, transmit audio and receive audio, and hopefully other people will do that too.
Okay, I hope so. I hope that people have respect for other people. I mean, unfortunately, there are times that people degrade the pleasantness of their signal transmission for more punchiness. Usually the Xers will put a compressor on and give their voice a rather harsh equalization curve. So that it's a little bit more annoying on the ear, but their attitude is that it will catch the attention of contesters on the other side. So I try to make my transmissions as comfortable to listen to as humanly possible. I hope everyone else does, but, you know, there are different people with different philosophies.
Yeah, I think that's true. And the best way to know is when you're transmitting, you're having QSO, and somebody says, wow, you got really excellent audio. What did you do there?
Well, yeah, I mean, sometimes people appreciate it. Other times people don't appreciate it. Some people tweak things very simply and satisfactory. And as I mentioned before, some guys get an entire rack of audio equipment.
QSO. Well, you know, I tried a bunch of different things. You know, we've discussed this, you know. Finally, I come down to what works best here. And, you know, even the kinds of external speakers that work and really inexpensive. Yeah, I don't think you have to go so much into the rack. I think that people can figure it out for cheap.
It depends on the individual. Some people can't figure things out, unfortunately, and others really like a lot of dials and knobs and adjustments. on any solution.
QSL, and they think they're reincarnated as Bob Hiles.
Well, Bob, God bless him, is still alive, so I don't think that's possible. I think you have to be dead to be reincarnated.
QSL, you'll get more out of your hobby, you know, and be happy, you know. KG2RY.
Okay, yeah, I think there's a lot of ways to extract more pleasure out of this hobby. As I've frequently mentioned, I can't think of any particular hobby that has the depth and breadth that our little hobby has. If you're bored with one thing, you can go to another, and another, and another, and another, and another. So there's always things out there, and there's levels of understanding. You choose which level that you feel comfortable with, and you stay there, I guess. I'm always kind of digging the onion skin out and looking at the next skin in. So, you know, different strokes for different folks. So, you know, keep on optimizing your audio, David. Rich, you still want to, anything else to say about that, antenna that you would like to try as a transmitting antenna?
Well, like I said, it's a small 30-inch loop. It's not a magnetic loop. It's just a 30-inch loop. It's a closed loop with the coax coming off each end of the, it's not a closed loop. It's an open loop with the blade tied to one end and the conductor tied to the other. And it normally goes into a little box, a little amplifier, and it does give it some pretty good amplification. But I was looking at the SWR on it, like I said, and right at 3.1 megacycles, it's showing a near 1.1-to-1 match. So, now, of course, that SWR isn't taking into consideration the power going into the antenna, and I wonder if that would, that couldn't change the SWR, but... if I put, 20 watts into that antenna, even though it's a small 30-inch loop antenna, am I at risk of heating up my finals beyond recognition? Go ahead.
AD2DK.
Yes, John.
Rich, don't do it. 20 watts through that RF amplifier. You're trying to go in through the outdoor. The fact that you're able to measure a near 1-to-1 SWR, that just means that, and I don't really know how you're measuring it, but, assuming you're using flea power, it's very, very possible that all you're really doing is finding the point at which the output impedance of that antenna is 50 ohms. The amplifier is 50 ohms. So my suspicion is if you took that amplifier out and just coupled the input to the output, that you would have a very, very big mismatch at 3.1 megahertz. And, at 3.1 megahertz, I'm going to say that 30-inch loop is, for all intents and purposes, a short circuit. And I wouldn't do it. I think your finals are going to thank you for it if you don't. Back to you.
Thanks, John. And I agree with you as well. As I mentioned, Rich, it's that amplifier that concerns me. You can't run a transmitter through an amplifier. And you can't be sure what the impedance is of the antenna if you're running your VNA through the amplifier. So theoretically, what you would need to do is remove the amplifier, plug in the VNA, and find what the VizWy is. From the way that you're describing that antenna, as John mentioned, I don't think you're going to get 1-to-1. So I think you're misinterpreting the VizWy based upon some of the circuits in the amplification box that it's hooked up to.
Adelaide 2H.
Yes, Lou.
satellite 2H.
Yes, Lou, please.
Did he say 3.1 megs? That'd probably be illegal.
Well, I kind of translated it, but yeah, the last time I talked to Rich, he was talking about 7.1, so I'm assuming he got his decimal point wrong, or he got his number wrong. But yes, that is outside the amateur radio band. So, Rich, what frequency are you finding this one-to-one resonance?
Is 40 meters. I'm talking about 80 meters.
Okay, so you can choose 3.5 all the way to 4, but you can't play in 3.1.
Just eyeballing the chart. Yeah, I do mean that. I'm sorry, guys. 3.5. Right in the 3.5 to 3.025 portion of the band. I'm running a sweep on it without the amplifier right now. I'll tell you what it returns. It'll be just 1 second.
Okay, it's times like this that I wish I had a drum roll ready.
John, ADTDK, off the chart.
As I expected, Rich.
How does that amplifier bring it down so much? What is the amplifier doing?
The amplifier is doing two things, right? It's taking the low impedance or the high impedance, depending on the frequency of that loop, and transforming it to 50 ohms, which is what your receiver wants to see, along with adding the signal. So I'm going to guess you're using a mini VNA and not, maybe not your transceiver to measure SWR. But you're in theory, assuming that the amplifier can sync the power that you're putting into it so as to be able to measure the VSWR, is that you're measuring where the output impedance of that amplifier is 50 ohms. But that does not necessarily mean that that you can transmit back through that amplifier, at least not if you want to keep that amplifier working. I say that jokingly, but, you get what I'm saying. Back to you guys.
And my 440 isn't plugged in. That's how certain I was of of doing this. But so I'm measuring the VSWR of the amplifier, the output of the amplifier. Huh, John?
Roger, roger.
All right, thank you for that. I knew it was wonky. That's why I would have never tried it without asking. But I had thought mistakenly, and I am using a nano VNA, I thought mistakenly that both the reading with and without the amplifier were the same. But guess what? It's not. It's way off the chart. It's pointing up somewhere close to where SpaceX wants to shoot their rocket. Thanks, John, and thanks, Roy. W2BC.
Thank you,
John.
Thank you, John.
Yeah, Craig?
For the right moment to cap it. I'm having a problem with something, and I think now is the time for a question.
Okay, very well. Just keep in mind that you're rather noisy, so if there's anything that you can do to kind of boost the signal to the repeater and drop the quieting down from about 60-70% to something like 30% would be thankful.
I should be able to get through on this, so I'll see if I can keep it as short as possible. Am I any better?
Yeah, it's a bit better.
So, I have a website on my computer that I use. I'm not going to talk exactly what it is, but let's just say it is a map that I on occasion use. And apparently my malware bite thinks that it's considered riskware and has blocked it, and I cannot connect to it. And I added it to the allowed list, and it's still not letting me in unless I shut off web protection, load the page, and then turn the web protection back on. What should I do?
Okay, that's an interesting one. Theoretically, if you put it in the permission list, it should allow it. So the only thing I can imagine is there's something wonky in that page that then calls another page, and that's the page that's giving you the problems. So offhand, my suggestion would be to have the turn off for a second, turn off your firewalls and such, call up the page, then directly request the source code for the page, copy it, cut and paste it, then lock things down, put back your firewall, and take a good look at the source code for that page and see if it's calling any other web page. Because my guess would be there are other web pages being summoned, and you have to put those permissions in as well.
So you're saying it's a web page in a web page?
Yes, many, many web pages are complicated affairs where they insert all kinds of other websites. So yeah, it's very common for a web page to pull out data from other web pages.
Well, I am going to spend 5 minutes doing just that. And if not, then I'm going to ask another one of my computer experts what I should do if I still can't figure it out. So, thank you, and I'm going to get to work before my cat demands that I play with her. So thank you, KD2OGB.
Okay, good luck, Craig, and come back and tell us how it worked out in some future technical net.
Got it. AC2GS, net control,
KD2OGB. Okay, Doc, let's try a little puzzle tonight. Last week, Andy brought you back to Mesopotamia and cuneiform, Sumerian cuneiforms, and how the number 360 were chosen for circles. So we're going to go in the exact opposite direction of theoretical physics. So these are unfortunately theories that have not been totally proven, but still I think it'll be interesting to discuss. Anyway, the question is, you have this magical little machine. It puts out photons. It puts out photons of one frequency. For the sake of argument, say it's the frequency that we see is the color red. And it has a dial on it. It's a magical dial that goes all the way from zero to infinity, which I know is impossible, but this is magic. So you're putting out the same frequency. The dial changes the intensity, the number of photons in the same space. Now, if anyone understands it, things like light can coexist in the same exact space. You can't put two electrons with the same quantum number in the same place. That's called the Pauli exclusion principle. It works for neutrons and protons and electrons. But bosons don't apply that rule, and so you can take as many photons as you want and put them together as tight as you want. So the question is there anything in nature that will limit your ability to turn that dial all the way from zero to an infinite number of continuous photons hitting a point in space? Or if you get a certain concentration of photons of the same energy at one point in space, do strange things happen with the laws of physics?
Something tells me this has a lot to do with math.
Surprisingly not, but then I wouldn't do that to anyone here. We try to keep this as low math as humanly possible. It is, for the most part, a conceptual question.
Well, you're talking about infinite numbers, so basically I'm thinking that it had to do with math, or just, I don't know, something else.
No, I'm setting the question.